you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour, and thank you for listening to the Twilight Histories. Once in a while, I like to do something fun with our supporters in Patreon. I ask them for show ideas, then farm those ideas out to our team of podcasters who turn them into fully produced short shows. We've done this in the past, and I know our patrons really enjoy hearing their ideas come to life. For today's show, I gave our patrons the title Oasis Lost. I had just seen Dune, so I was thinking of something deserty. But of course, I had no clue what our patrons would come up with. 14 ideas were submitted, and I'll just tell you some of the runners-up so you get an idea of the caliber of these ideas. I think they're fantastic. And I was also surprised that many of them were actually off-world. Did our patrons also see Dune? So here's the first one. Nicholas Menapace, or Menapace? I'm sorry. He wrote, "When the first humans walk on Mars, they discover something that no probe had seen, and what cannot be. Not just life, but humans, an Atlantis of the sands." Here's another one. Ethan Warren also had a space theme. He wrote, "When the first humans land on the moon, they are met by humanoids who guide the explorers into their hidden world beneath the moon's surface. Are they alien? Or the last survivors of an Earth-based, pre-human civilization?" Aaron Gullison wrote, "A tourist thought lost in the Venusian desert stumbles back to civilization with tales of an oasis of fresh water and green plants. Is he insane? Or is there more to his tale?" There were plenty of other great ideas from our patrons, and even those ideas that don't get picked, just know that I do jot those down. I have a running list of my favorite ideas from our patrons, so don't feel that just because your idea wasn't used here, that it's dead in the water. We'll see if we can't do something in the future. Okay, for the first story you're going to hear today, our podcaster Tristan Verboven picked a very interesting patron-generated concept that kind of reminds me of the film Looper. Steve DeFalco wrote this as his idea. "A world within a world. You move through what seems to be two fractured worlds, weaving in and out of each other. It's disorienting. Maybe a result of world splitting? Maybe something else?" Let's hear how Tristan Verboven treated this concept from Steve DeFalco. This story is called A Soldier's Death.
The natives call it Fekfek, indistinguishable from the hot sand and hard dirt. It's like talcum powder, the silent killer. Worse than an air raid or an ambush, it will swallow a truck whole, leaving a convoy choking in the dust. But these men live in a world of dust, matted into their beards and shaggy locks, faces scorched in the sun, headscarves held fast with goggles. It's the winter of 1941, though you wouldn't know it in Africa. We are the infamous British Long Range Desert Group, hardy men from New Zealand, hand-picked for endurance. We've crossed the Egyptian desert, we've crossed the Libyan desert, and on the way, dry heat has worn away decorum. We live as vandals once did, cutting the African wind on motorized steeds to fight the modern armies of Rome. Quite a ride for this truck, right off the Chevy assembly line in Cairo, stripped down and fitted for war, jerry cans on every inch of her, bullet holes to show for it. 82 men and 21 vehicles when we raided Mazurko Oasis not 10 days ago, but a single Italian plane has gradually reduced us down to 4 men in one truck broken and battered. And while these men dream of peeling off their crusty uniform over a cold pint back in Alex, Captain Moore knows it won't happen till that cursed bird is out of the sky. So instead of the long drive to Big Kern in Egypt, we make our way through the wasteland to French Chad. We travel by dusk and dawn. Desert nights are too dark, and in the noonday sun the horizon becomes a haze, and the sand will melt your tires. Nothing lives out here. Nothing. One advantage to crossing the Sahara is no one is expecting you, and many don't even believe it can be done. 30 kilometers into Chad, in the French Colonial Army convoy, 300 Senegalese crack riflemen and 24 armored transport. Their regiments have already faced Vichy in Morocco, Germans in France, who refused to surrender to them and paid the price, and now it's the Italians' turn to underestimate them. The sentries in red flat-top fez and beige shorts snap their Berthier rifles to attention. Moore lifts his goggles and douses the patch around his eyes from a canteen, letting it drip down his beard. Colonel Leclerc sweeps aside his white flapping headscarf, revealing the neat mustachioed lip of an aristocrat, worn to leather by years in the colonies.
Captain Moore,
he salutes.
Still in the fight, I see.
They say he traded a life of horsecraft and cushy officer duties for the company of legionnaires and colonial recruits. And despite a German bullet in his leg, he decided to command the last French army, 300 tirailleurs across the African desert, just to stay in the war.
Nice day for it,
smiles Moore, saluting the Frenchman. He nods to his vehicle.
The old girl could use a topper. Get us kitted up, be good as gold.
The colonel instructs his men to replenish our supplies. Fresh water, fuel, ammo, and food to get us back to Egypt.
It's time to let you in on the plan.
He spreads a map across the hood of his half-track.
We have some recon from our patrols.
A camel train stands by. Lanky beasts wobbling in the heat. Perched figures. Chamba from the Badlands of northern Chad, with a few hardy Free French officers at their mercy, commanding them.
I tell you, Captain Moore,
says the colonel.
Those Meharists, they scare the hell out of me.
An officer atop woven saddle in blue French uniform and helmet salutes as his beast grunts to a stop. He points to the map.
Voici l'objectif.
It's a vast swath of Libyan desert, and in the center a tiny point.
Kufra Oasis is a small outpost. Airstrip with a light bomber on blocks and some recon vehicles. Maybe a couple of hundred Libyan recruits.
He lights a cigarette.
My scouts tell me the caravans stopped coming through here years ago. This is a patch of Sahara the size of France and defended by a single garrison with one aircraft.
That's the bugger that took down my squadron,
says Moore.
Bit of a sore spot.
A sore spot indeed. That plane has become Moore's white whale.
They are expecting a counterattack from Egypt, not Chad,
says the colonel, leaning up on his cane.
France may have surrendered, but we will show them that de Gaulle still wants to fight.
Leclerc's plan seems pretty sound. He's right. The Italians are looking for us, not this French convoy. So we'll drive ahead and draw fire while he gets into position. And if Kufra's anything like the outposts we've seen so far, they'll throw down their guns at the sight of them. so by dusk we are on the move. Keeping the sun to our left, we follow the old caravan route north into Libya. Four of us crammed into a single truck with a couple of Vickers 303s, more keeping keen watch of the skies. We stop at a patch of brush called Sala. The well is brine, but good to quench the hood and wheels, and gives Leclerc time to mobilize. Then, due north, keeping a steady clip down flat path to the desert west of Kufra. Moore stops to scan the horizon, something kicking up dust headed south.
Bad news, boys,
he says grimly.
Looks like they've got their own long-range desert group.
First the breeze of bullets flying over, then the crackle of gunfire, and the ominous drone of an airplane. The driver quickly throws it into gear and towards the distant hills, the only cover for miles. Moore points the Vicar into the sky and unleashes furiously as the truck is riddled.
Taking a hiding here, bro.
Out of the sun comes a shower of fire. Tossing the vehicle head over heels in the scream of propellers. Moore and the others are thrown into the dirt as the flaming car lands with a smash. Your vision is blurry, but you can feel the pain of at least four bullets in your body, and you try to scream, but your lungs don't respond. You choke and claw at the sand till there's nothing. Brace yourself. It's time to flip.
Bella mira, artigliere.
The machine vibrations shake your body to the core. Your machine gun fills the opening in the light fuselage overlooking the dusty battlefield. The engines roar as you make another sweep over the scene, the smoking vehicles littered with bodies.
Ciao, ciao, Inglesi,
calls back the co-pilot laughing. Slowly the smoking debris falls into the distance, and the craft once again regains altitude. Removing your leather gloves, fingers drenched in sweat, trigger scorching, you slump back, watching the spent casings dance across the floor. From this altitude, you could see the desert in its savage splendor, brownish yellow, baking in the sun. Kufra Oasis comes into view. As you circle it, the earth comes into focus. Heavy, fragrant grass and palm, and the thud of rough, unpaved dirt. When the craft comes to a stop, the steady tarmac feels uneasy under your feet. You and the pilots head to a cluster of buildings, trading salutes with a young commanding officer in khakis and a gumdrop hat. The pilots peel away their leather caps and jackets.
That was the last one from the Mazurka raid,
he beams.
Nice work, men,
replies the commander.
Let's get you out of this sun.
The officers and mobile unit seem to be the only Italians. The rest are Berbers in tasseled tight headdress with baggy trousers and cummerbund. And the trees offer a cool shade you haven't felt in a while. Pilots unload in the tiny officers' mess.
Once we're refueled and ready, we'll do another patrol along the Egyptian border,
says the pilot.
Don't worry, they'll be back.
The commander invites you and the pilots to his mess table. Visibly chuffed by the victory, he breaks out what looks like a special bottle, and despite his rank, he is much younger. The pilots humor him accordingly as they raise a glass to the portrait of Mussolini. And as they down the bottle, the desert slips away, and before long, their minds are back in Ancona, taking in the evening air. You slip away to check out the base. buildings spread out within a fenced enclosure. A couple of observation towers, barracks, radio tower, a depot, and a small Berber settlement grazing goats and camels. Nothing lives beyond the shade, and in every direction the vastness of the Sahara bears down. The Berber Askari sentries lazily guarding the perimeter. They must see the oasis for what it is, an island. What could they expect to see from this tranquil patch of life in a lifeless world? And as the sun settles on the western horizon, the soldiers welcome a break from the biting sun. If only they knew what was lurking in the rocks and dunes. And then it happens. The oasis is lit up with muzzle flash from beyond the fence. You sprint through sniper fire and mortar back to the airstrip, and the shell barely misses the magazine, and the pilots wave you to the tarmac, determined to get the plane in the air. But a spray of crossfire cuts them down in their tracks, and a sharp stab in your leg throws you to the ground. The plane bursts into flames before your eyes. For several moments, you lay in the hard dirt as the battle rages on around you. The dwindling light turns the sky a magical color, and the orchestra of war dances around you, pieces flying through the air. But all you can do is lie in pain, pretending to be dead. Until the light is blocked by a face, an African tirailleur, firmly pointing his long bayoneted rifle at you. He turns his head facing the setting sun. His face. He has your face. Your eyes lock. Definitely your face. Cannot take the pain any longer.
Ole man!
He shouts. Smiling, you start to raise your hands, but pain is too much. It's time to flip. You reach for your sidearm instead.
That was A Soldier's Death, written and produced by Tristan Verboven, and based on a concept by one of our patrons, Steve DeFalco. As soon as Tristan wrapped this one up, I let Steve hear it. And I just have to quote you his response because it kind of blows my mind. Steve DeFalco wrote this to me. I just listened to A Soldier's Death. It was fantastic. Tristan is so good at building these intricate worlds. I was in the army. I was infantry for 5 years. Do me a favor and tell Tristan that, as someone who has been in combat, those parts of the story with the battles were amazing. I loved it. Yeah, powerful stuff. Steve told me he'd fought in Iraq, and I've got to hand it to you, Steve, if you're listening. I've got a lot of respect for you for doing that. I was doing some archaeology near Iraq when you were there back in 2007. I drove right up to the border and then promptly turned around. So hats off to you, Steve, for being right in the combat zone. It's no joke. Okay, we have another short coming up. But first, have a listen to this podcast promo from my man over at Historical Blindness.
Mysteries, hoaxes, conspiracy. Topics sometimes avoided by historians who don't want to draw attention to the blind spots in our knowledge of the past. But stories like these, fraught with ambiguities, teach us to view the past and the present with a critical eye. Join me, Nathaniel Lloyd, as I delve into these stories on my podcast, Historical Blindness, and shine a light in the darker corners of the past. New episodes every other Tuesday, available on Apple Podcasts and most podcast apps.
That was Historical Blindness. Go check it out. For the next show, Our podcaster, Devin Field, was inspired by this fascinating concept by Ryan Feather. Ryan wrote, Victorian's descendants live as sacred animals in a nation-sized, decrepit greenhouse paradise built to escape a ruined world. I have to say, this concept is so Devin Field, and I'm not surprised in the least that he picked it. This is The Glass House, written and produced by Devin Field, and inspired by a concept by our patron, Ryan Feather.
Beneath the weight of your boots, the earth is brittle. With each step, it crackles in the cold. You pause a moment to adjust the strappings of your equipment, shifting sore muscles about in search of comfort. And then you continue. You must not stop. Not here. Not while what little warmth is left of the day slips past and is gone. Not in this brief period, when the ruined skies allow it. A few more steps, then you approach the crest of the hill. Your destination coming into view beyond. You sigh in relief. The map was accurate again. You plod down the slope towards the entrance, your eyes taking in the structure. It's big, easily the biggest you've seen, and in good shape, too. Its hundreds of iron columns still stretch up towards the sky. Its thousands of rectangular glass plates still nestle neatly in those iron arms, most of them unbroken. There is something in the pleasing geometry of these buildings that sparks something in your mind. You walk closer to the glass house. It really is in good shape. The best of any you've found. Maybe even... You don't allow yourself to finish the thought. No, better just to look for shelter, supplies, any signs of where they might have gone. Better to just wait and see what you do find. A few more steps, and you reach the entrance to the glass house. You breathe in deep and put your weight to the door. At first, it resists. But then, with a sigh of complaint, it opens. You freeze in shock. There are people inside. No, you laugh at your own skittish foolishness. There are statues lined up in the shadows inside the entrance, as if to receive royalty. You breathe out shakily, and step up to the first stone figure. A slender, bearded man in a mustache and cap, who inspects the flower in his hand. You glance down at the name at its base. John Parkinson. He's not someone you know, and neither is the next one. An André Le Nôtre, in lavish hair and costume, a scroll unwinding from his right hand. Nor is Joseph Paxton after that, though he does sound more familiar. You pass by the others and pause beneath an iron archway, letting your eyes adjust to the dim light and the vast space before you, letting yourself drink it all in. Here, the space opens up. The boards beneath your feet open up to make way for the three thick trees that push towards the ceiling above. Around them are openings to other rooms, other portals in wood and iron, and everywhere, glass. You take a step forward and pause again, listening. It's like standing in the ribs of a giant. You can hear the rattling gasp of air against loose panes, the pulsing drip and drop of a multitude of leaks. And then, something else. The odd calls of what must be birds, and some other, fainter noises. You listen for a moment, and then let your attention wander. Let your feet follow. You circle round to the right of the trees and into one of the halls, into a scene of lavish decay. though you've happened across something of the sort in other glasshouses. You don't recognize the specific trees here in this room, or what's left of them. You assume it's something exotic. Certainly nothing that would grow outside now. And there's a hint of sweetness to the rot in the air that tells you they might have borne fruit. There is movement at the corner of your eye, and you turn just in time to see a lizard skitter out of sight, darting in among the roots. Who knows how many other little lives they conceal? You drift from one room to another, finding no shortage of life, but none of it human. In one room, you hear a low hubbub behind a door, and slide it open to find chickens, many of them, spilling over into other rooms past a broken plate of glass. Has someone been caring for them? You stare for a moment, startled, your stomach growling. You'll definitely come back later. You slide the doors closed again. One hall is lined with art, and you linger over a few of the paintings, which have largely managed to escape the leaks. The first shows the remnants of a stone building, just an archway, really, and the suggestion of walls, with snow-bitten skeletons of trees clawing up at a dark sky. In the second, a figure stands atop a rocky height with his back to you, seeming to consider the misty landscape that confronts you both. You rather like the two paintings, and you're about to have a closer look at a third when you hear a scraping sound from down the hall. It seems to be coming from beyond the next archway. You step cautiously forward over a fallen bird's nest and into the next room. It has a pyramid in it. You stop and stare in contemplation. This you haven't seen before. It dominates the room's center, all its smooth angles in a stone, which you also aren't familiar with. Perhaps the builders even brought the materials from across the sea, back when such things were done. You walk around it, around the green bronze figures that seem to stand watch at its walls. Monstrous ones on four legs with human faces. Others with the bodies of humans, but the faces of animals. A bird, some kind of dog, a lion. There are no chickens for you here. There is nobody, no, nothing that matters to you. You turn away. The halls, rooms, and hallways of this building seem endless. An iron, wood, and glass spiderweb, with ever a new thread after the last. You should choose somewhere to make camp for the night. You know this. But instead, you press on, feet carrying you forward, as if under some compulsion. Some mania to know the contents of the next room, and then the one after. Besides, you argue to yourself, how could you sleep before you know what else walks this floor? Something does, certainly. There are sounds, and they are not all from branches against the glass or chickens. Not only the wind. You call out, hello? There is no answer. You keep walking. Through one hall and the next you go. The rose room is overgrown, but lovely enough in its now rough and wild way, doing much better than the fruit trees. The one after that contains some kind of device, with 12 stained little bottles arranged in a circle and affixed to small hammers and bells. It clearly once served some purpose, but exactly what, you can't imagine. You're turning away when something metallic among the debris by the wall catches your eye. A kind of a horn, what shine it had, long muted. You brush away the dirt, and without knowing quite why, you raise it to your lips and blow. The sound it produces is not nice. A keening wail that sputters out into nothing, though you don't know if that's your fault or the instrument's. But everywhere around you, the glasshouse is suddenly alive with noises. The horn call echoing, the birds erupting in panic, the sounds of other things that cannot possibly be birds. Can they? You're frozen, horn still clutched in hand, as you wait for the unsettling yelping and scrabbling to subside. You gently place the horn back where you found it, and you press on, towards the last of the noise, and into another room. What god was worshipped here? There is a low stone wall on one side, or what's left of it. There are columns, some capped at their full height, others shattered short of reaching it. But when, and by what force? You do not see signs of wreckage on the ground. Was the glasshouse built over these ruins, just as with the trees by the entrance? Or were the ruins built within the structure, just exactly as you see them now? You have suspected as much at other sites you found, but none of them so developed as this. Your gaze wanders over the contours of the ruins, if that is indeed what they are. It follows the line of the columns down until it settles on the glass behind them. There, in the failing light of the day, you can just see your reflection, and behind you, in the doorway, a face. You whirl around, but the face is gone. Still, you're certain of what you saw. A face hovering in the dark, and beneath it, the shadowy suggestion of a body, of a person. You rush to the door, but they're gone. You call out down the corridor, "Wait!" In a doorway ahead, a shape, low and scuttling, is silhouetted for a moment, and then disappears from your view. You break into a run, plunging forward into the gathering dark. Your shin crashes into something on the ground, and you curse. "Wait!" But there is no one there.
That was The Glass House, written and produced by Devin Field and inspired by a concept by our patron, Ryan Feather. So, what do you think? Was that fun or what? And hey, would you like your idea given the royal treatment just like this? Would you like your name featured here at the Twilight Histories? Well, that could happen, because we're going for another round. The title of our next Patreon-generated show will be called The Underworld. What does the underworld inspire in you? Maybe something to do with the Sibyl leading Aeneas down into the caves where some high-tech civilization sleeps? Or perhaps a poor, soot-lunged Victorian miner discovers something that will change the course of history? I don't know. It's your imagination and your idea. Come on over to Patreon and add your idea as a comment to the post called The Underworld. Here's what I recommend. Keep it simple. Just a sentence or two, or a couple lines at most. Don't get bogged down with names and dates. Try to focus instead on stimulating the imaginations of our podcasters. Your idea should be like a honey trap. It should be tasty. If a podcaster picks your idea, let them figure out the names and dates. You just focus on a cool concept. Again, to add your idea for The Underworld, and hopefully get it fully produced by one of our team, join us on Patreon. You will not only get a chance, and a pretty good chance, to get one of your ideas produced, but you'll also get early access to all our shows, a ton of members-only shows going back a decade, and you'll be supporting the growth of the Twilight Histories. This show is only possible with the support of members like you who sign up. We've been reinvesting everything into growing the show. We've been hiring podcasters, upgrading recording equipment, and sourcing art for our role-playing game. There's so much more we can do as we grow our supporters. And we're going to get there, one patron at a time. You can find a link to our Patreon page by going to the Twilight Histories website at twilighthistories.com and clicking on the Patreon link. Or just go directly to Patreon and run a search for the Twilight Histories. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care. Many, many times, listeners have asked me if I've heard the podcast Our Fake History. They keep telling me I'd love it, and I keep telling them I'm already a fan. What Our Fake History does is turn the past upside down. It explores the past in search of fascinating things we might have gotten wrong. Are there historical legends that are actually true? Are there things we all believe happened but were in fact made up? Is the past what we think it is, or is it stranger and more fascinating than we had imagined? If you're a Twilight Histories fan, you know that casting you into worlds where things are familiar yet surprising is what we're all about, and that's why our fans love Our Fake History. I recommend you check it out. Again, that's Our Fake History.